Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. You know, last Monday was the new moon of the sixth month, and I was very impressed that the state of Florida gave us the day off. But then it turns out that it's the new moon of Ramadan, so I'm suspicious now. Anyway, I hope you had a good Labor Day, and I got to watch, every year I always try to watch a little bit of the Jerry Lewis telethon and see how people are responding to that. And there was a time when Rebecca was in college where she led a group of volunteers answering phones. I remember one time she grabbed a bunch of people. I'm not sure that they really were prepared. And this was in Big Sandy. She grabbed a bunch of people, more or less dragged them out of bed in the wee hours of the morning, and got them down to Tyler, Texas, to the TV channel there. And they were attractive, but they were all, they looked probably like they just got up, you know. But I think the announcer at the time said, look at these all, these young, you know, co-eds here, you know, please call or whatever, you know. But anyway, we're going to be dealing with that kind of a subject today. In fact, women who are doing good work. In fact, I want to get into that subject a bit. I want to first talk about the fact that if we're going to do anything, if we're going to accomplish anything, we need to know what we're doing. You know, you don't want to go off half-cocked and then have to undo what you did because you didn't know what you were doing. Or you don't want to not respond when you ought to respond, you know. A lot of harm can be done because you don't do what's necessary. So to begin with, I want to go to the book of James. I call this talk Watching Women, Watching Wise Women Work. Watching Wise Women Work. Notice the alliteration, you literary buffs. Watching Wise Women Work is what I want to talk about today. Now, if I talk about wise women, of course, some of you are going to, you know, right away come to mind. What's going to come to your mind is Naomi and Ruth. And I know that Boaz, before he met the daughter-in-law of Naomi, he was ruthless. And he, he appreciated Ruth. And another name that'll come to mind, of course, will be Esther. But we won't deal with those very well-known women. I'm going to deal with women who were very wise and who did good works and whom we ought to watch in the sense of reading their examples. But these are women who are perhaps not quite as well-known as the ones I named, Ruth and Esther. We'll say more about those women. In fact, one of them isn't even specifically named in the Bible. But we'll deal with her today. We'll talk about her today. So this is Watching Wise Women Work. I want to go, first of all, to the book of James. And let's face it, if we think about it, we realize the importance of wisdom. If you know a lot, then you've got knowledge. And if you can relate one fact to another, you have understanding. But wisdom is the ability to apply that understanding, to actually live a way of life, you know, make decisions based on your understanding, to apply what you know and understand. And wisdom is not an easy thing. It often is acquired, you know, as we say in the school of hard knocks. A lot of times simply living, and you go through certain experiences. You're programmed in life to just go through certain experiences, and you learn lessons from them. If you're wise, you'll consider what you've gone through and try to learn lessons. And you want to make sure, however, you don't learn the wrong lessons. That's why it's important to have others whom you respect and you can talk over things, because sometimes you can in your own mind put a certain spin on events and learn the wrong lesson from events. But the point is that there is more to reality than what's around us. There really is. There is a spiritual dimension. God is the ultimate reality. So if we want wisdom, which we need to go to the source. And so the Bible is insisting upon our going to God for wisdom, because He can add to what we normally would be able to do on our own. He can give us wisdom from on high. And so please, if we want to make the right decisions in life and avoid making wrong decisions, we need to keep our relationship with God and go to Him for wisdom. In the book of James, the first chapter, the fifth verse, he says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given him. You know, God doesn't want you to be a fool. He wants you to be wise. So if you ask him, for wisdom, he'll give it to you. There are a lot of interesting verses about wisdom, and wisdom in the Bible is allegorized as a woman. What's the word I'm thinking of? It's personified as a woman. In the Greek, wisdom is Sophia. We even use that as a name today for women. Sophia is wisdom, and it's feminine. And in the Hebrew, wisdom is Chokmah, and that's also grammatically feminine. And so when poets write of wisdom, they write of wisdom as a female. And there's interesting verses about wisdom that I want to go to. And, of course, obviously, if you want to talk about wisdom, you'll go to Proverbs. So let's go back to the book of Proverbs. And first of all, you see how wisdom is personified as a female, Sophia, or in the Hebrew, Chokmah. In Proverbs 8, it says, Does not wisdom cry out and understanding lift up her voice? She takes her stand on the top of the high hill, beside the way where the paths meet. She cries out by the gates at the entry of the city, at the entrance of the doors. So here wisdom is crying out as a woman crying out, you know, come and follow me, you know, take my have me as a partner in your life, as a guide in your life. And in this book of Proverbs, in the 15th chapter and verse 33, we understand that if you're going to have wisdom, what you first of all need to understand is that our life is of greatest value if it is ethically lived, that there is a reality beyond the physical. The fear of the eternal is the instruction of wisdom. So if we're, the key point of wisdom is fear of the eternal, having that respect for God and therefore wanting to please God. The fear of the eternal is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. One of the greatest characteristics, one of the greatest elements in wisdom is humility. You won't even want to evaluate your actions if you don't have humility. You'll be so arrogant, you'll think, who, me? You know, why, you know, I'm great, I don't make mistakes. Or you won't want to go to other people for advice because, what, they don't have anything to contribute. Obviously we don't utter those things normally, but sometimes we act almost as if we do believe those things. I mean, if anybody ever boxed you into a corner, you probably wouldn't really say that you think you're to be all and end all. But that's sometimes how we act. So before honor is humility. That's certainly a critical element in wisdom. And I want to go now to Proverbs the 9th chapter and the 10th verse. Proverbs 9 and verse 10. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So remember in life that there are standards that need to be maintained. There are some areas that in fact are sacred, and that we need to be aware of that. We're meeting today on the Sabbath, for example, because we have that awareness of the importance of the Sabbath. You know, since I've been working out, in, quote-unquote, in the world, you might say, I have really developed an appreciation for the Sabbath, for you just to close it out, you know, one day out of seven. You know, not that I don't like it, or I mean, don't like my job. I don't mean it that way, but you know, just that change of pace—it's just such a tremendous blessing. And yet, God has to tell us to do it because we wouldn't normally do it. You know, you find reasons not to do it if you don't have to. In Proverbs 4, and verse 7, we're told. And by the way, I give a lot of credit to my physics teacher. He taught me physics, but he also taught me this proverb. You know, he would put wise sayings on the board before physics class. He was a devout Presbyterian, tithed to his church. He was a World War II veteran. His name was McGee, Mr. McGee. Anyway, in was that the name of that guy that in those cartoons? Oh, Magoo. That was Mr. Magoo. All right, I'm sorry. All right, well, that's better. Yeah, all right. Anyway, Proverbs 4 and verse 7. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom, and with all you're getting, get understanding. So in this life, as we go through life, to trying to put food on the table, you know, clothes on our backs, a roof over our head, and so on. You know, let's not forget to try to learn something in the process. Let's just not acquire things. Let's learn something in the process. You know, as Socrates said, if you want to be secular, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living, Socrates said. And, you know, I'll give him credit for saying that. Or Plato said it, you know, claiming that he said it. Probably he did. So these are sayings about wisdom in the Bible. This is what God inspired for us to know. And I want to go to the Psalms now. There's an acrostic psalm, a psalm that's in alphabetical order. And it's some, of course, there are several like that. In Psalm 111, there are seven acrostic psalms, but this is one of them. Psalm 111 and verse 10. Psalm 111 and verse 10. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. Reshit chokmah yirat Adonai. The beginning of wisdom is the beginning of fear. I'm sorry. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. Okay, Tehel Tov L'Chol Osehim Tehilat Tov Medet La'ad. I know this by heart because we would say it every day in my community. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those that do them. Do what do you mean do them? Well, obviously, you know what God tells you to do, because he says the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. If you study the Bible, as one young man from Europe told me, he was a very studious man. His father was a minister in the French-speaking world. This young man was a student of mine, and he studied the concept of the fear of the Eternal. And he told me from his studies, the fear of the Eternal is that which motivates one to obey. So the fear of the Eternal is tied in with obedience. And so that's why it says, the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do them. Meaning, of course, do his commandments. That's why your translator put in italics that do his commandments. And so if we do them, we understand more and more. You actually understand from the doing. Sure, you can read about the commandments, but when you do them, then you have a deeper understanding. When you actually live the way of life, a deeper understanding comes to you than just from theory. Practice helps you to really understand. His praise endures forever. So there are some women who understood this, and they had a relationship with God. And there were three elements that these women shared. They were God-centered rather than self-centered. That's a very important element in being wise, to be God-centered rather than self-centered, which is not as easy as you think. It's easy to say it. It's not as easy to live that way. And secondly, to be concerned for others. And again, it's so easy to just be selfish and be concerned about one's own convenience. And I know some, you know, my children have the opportunity to work with people a lot when they're out to have a good time. But they see these people sometimes just consumed with their own situation, and they get all bent out of shape about the slightest inconvenience sometimes, waiting in a line a few minutes extra, whatever it is. You know, now I know it's not everybody, fortunately, but there are enough of these sourpusses, you know, and they have dealt with it over the years, and so they understand the seamier side of human nature in that sense. So concern for others is certainly a very important element. And the third element that these women shared is a commitment to do the right thing, even if it's difficult. And this is, by the way, what one of the lessons that was learned by Maria von Trapp. And, you know, I saw not Julie Andrews, but the real Maria von Trapp give a speech, and Rebecca was there. This was years ago. She's not alive anymore, Maria von Trapp, the original one. Julie Andrews still is. But anyway, Maria von Trapp said the same thing. You know, you want to know what God's will is and to do it even if it's difficult. She actually, evidently, her first choice was to be a nun rather than marry Captain von Trapp. But you know, she began to realize, no, God wants me to marry this man, and so she did. And that worked out well. I think she would say in retrospect that worked out well for her. So these women were God-centered rather than self-centered. They were concerned for others. They had concern for others, and they were committed to do the right thing, even if it was difficult. Now, first one I want to talk about is Deborah. And Deborah's back in 1200 B.C. Now, she was inspired to put a poem together, perhaps she and her companion, Barak. She was inspired to put a poem together that is considered a great work of literature, and it's hundreds of years before Homer. You know, Homeric literature is considered so great, and scholars are just amazed by what they see in Judges 5, because here we have poetry of the same nature as the Greek classic poetry, and yet it even precedes the work of Homer. But I don't want to get to Judges 5 yet. Before we have the poem of victory, let's see what the problem was, okay? So let's go back to the problem first, and that's in Judges 4. When Ehud was dead, so here's a judge that had helped Israel, but he died. This is Judges 4. When Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Eternal. So the Eternal sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. I guess they call it Hazor in American language, Hazor. Anyway, he lived in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim, which might, you know, there's a lot of different ideas about what the name of that town meant, but it might have meant international woods. Why? It might have been an area that a lot of people traveled across in war and in doing business and trading. But it was evidently a wooded area where a lot of people passed through. But that's just speculation. There's different ideas what the name might mean. But anyway, we are dealing with a time when Israel is oppressed by the Canaanites because they've sinned. And so once again, they need deliverance. But this time, the Canaanites are technologically advanced. And the Israelites, in effect, are the underdogs in this struggle. Verse 3, and the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron. And for 20 years he had harshly oppressed the children of Israel. So the Israelites had 20 years of this oppressive rule, and the man had technology at his disposal, which in those years was helping to prop up his regime. Now here we have Deborah. Now Deborah, a prophetess. So she was an inspired preacher, Deborah. Now, Deborah, now what do I mean by an inspired preacher? I mean that that she could go to men, leading men of the day, and give them advice and give them counsel that came directly from God to her. It was her role to tell them, in effect, to be a spokesperson for God. That's what a prophetess did. You know, she would go to the ruler and say, you know, this is the latest, this is the word. Or the ruler would go to her and say, what is the word? Or the ruler might go to her and say, please go to God and receive the word, you know. So she was a special advisor who had a direct link with God in that sense, who was inspired by God, unlike the men, but they could go to her for that kind of advice. But in those days, the men in Israel were you know, what's the right word? There were not a lot of heroic men. Leadership was at a premium in those days. There were not a lot of leaders among the men. And so she wound up governing the country. Not only was she was a prophetess, but because the men had kind of shrunk from leadership positions, she was also governing, judging. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. She was in the northern part of the country. Well, she judged from the central part, but she evidently had influence in the northern kingdom, or what became the northern kingdom. And she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now, maybe she was an Ephraimitish woman, so I call her the Maggie Thatcher of biblical days. All right. So then she sent and called for Barak. So all the way to Hawaii. No, this is Barak, the son of Abinoam. This Barak is not the same Barak as what you've heard of. As Barack Obama explained when he was down here in Florida, you know, he came down to South Florida and spoke to synagogues down here. And he mentioned to the people in the synagogue, my name Barak is like the Hebrew name Baruch. You know, Baruch is a common Hebrew name. It means blessed. It's also a family name. One of the great advisors to presidents a half a century ago was Bernard Baruch, who did have a relationship with President Eisenhower. Anyway, and Baruch, as you know, was the scribe of Jeremiah. Now, a lot of Jews wanted to give their sons the name Baruch, but in America, you know, there was a lot of bigotry, so they gave him the name Barry. That's why a lot of Jews had the name Barry a generation ago. Probably their Hebrew name was Baruch, and they went by the name Barry on the street. Well, anyway, so this Barak is not Baruch, but it's Barak. It's a different Hebrew word, and it means lightning. So it's not the same as the name of Barack Obama, which is Arabic for blessed. This is Barak, meaning lightning. Anyway, Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh in Naphtali, she called for him and said to him, has not the eternal God of Israel commanded? Go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor. Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun. So she's basically telling him, do it. You know, God has said you should do it. So why hold back? Do it. And against you, I will deploy Sisera. You know, God already, through Deborah, had predicted what was going to happen. You know, and against you I will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude at the river Kishon, and I will deliver him into your hand. This is near the present city of Haifa. And Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. Now that's interesting. Here's a commander-in-chief of northern Israel, and he cannot win his campaign unless he goes to a female governor. Wonder if that's ever happened to him since then. Anyway, and Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. All right? So she said, she was a prophetess. She was more than a governor. She was a prophetess. So you don't want to go without your local prophetess, you know. So she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey. You are asking. In other words, you're such a, whatever the word is, I don't know. I don't want to say the word. You know, what Arnold Schwarzenegger would have a term for it, you know. Anyway, you're such a wimp. I'll say that. You're such a wimp that, you know, you're not going to wind up beating this guy. It's going to be a woman that's going to beat this guy. And back in the ancient Middle East, you know, losing to a woman was culturally, you know, not so good. But okay, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking, for the Eternal will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. As we'll see, you'll see what happened later. Then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kedesh, and Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh. He went with 10,000 men under his command, and Deborah went up with him. And now there was a Gentile who happened to be in the area, he figures in because of his wife. You know, he was a Gentile, so he was not in the battle. And he had a good relationship with the commander of the Canaanite army. So he had moved away from his people and kind of gotten out of, I guess, out of where he thought the action was going to be. He was trying probably to be in a safer area, you know, like evacuating, like people right now are evacuating from hurricanes in this part of the country. Now, Heber, the Kenite of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, there's complications as to Hobab and how he fits in the scheme of things. It may have been another name for Jethro. That's a whole subject for another time, but it may have been another name for Jethro. Now Heber, the son of Heber of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the terebinth tree at Zaanayim, which is beside Kedesh. And they reported this. So he comes up later in the story, or his wife does. That's why he's mentioned here. And they reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. Then Deborah said to Barak, by the way, if you ever see the classic movie Exodus, there's a discussion of this in that movie as well. Then Deborah said to Barak, up! For this is the day in which the Eternal has delivered Sisera into your hand. Very inspiring, very encouraging, because she was a prophetess and she could speak this way. Has not the Eternal gone out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. So you see the role that she played. She wasn't out to build herself up, but she was trying to encourage him to be a man, you know, to take the leadership. And she was telling him, you do it, God is with you. And she was there to inspire him to do it. The wind beneath his wings, as it were. And the Eternal routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. That's kind of a funny way for a general to act, isn't it? You know, he's losing the battle, so he runs away. I guess maybe you could say, well, you know, this way I can rally what's left and come back and fight another time. Maybe that's the justification for that. Anyway, the leader sneaks off. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth HaGoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. Wow, total victory, total extermination of the enemy, except the general. And he's very important, you know, and he gets away. However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, which is the meaning of this is like a mountain goat or, you know, that kind of an animal, a gazelle-type animal or goat-like animal. However, Sisera had fled away to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. You know, he was not an Israelite, and so they didn't have a quarrel there, I guess. They'd made some arrangement, you know, they were not at war. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, this is the wife of Heber, And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear." Now, he's not going to fear from a woman being there. Her husband's not there. Evidently, there's not a lot of young men around. She's just a woman around, as far as we know. So why should this general, this warrior, be afraid of her, right? "Do not fear." And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket. So she's, you know, being motherly and taking care of him. Then he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." So she opened the jug of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him. Now, I don't know if this is true, but doesn't milk kind of help you relax and go to sleep? And I think that was part of the point here. She wanted him to get sleepy. And he said to her, "Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there any man here?' you shall say, 'No.'" Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. Now, sure, the guy was asleep, but even so, this is a courageous act. You know, I've talked about Deborah and her connection with God and her courage and how she inspired the commander to do his part, how she supported Barak. And now we see an example here of Jael, how she did the right thing. She's supporting the people of Israel. They've been oppressed by the Canaanites. Here's one of the great tyrants of the Canaanites, a great military leader. And she actually has the courage to do away with him. Now, sure, he was asleep and she was sneaking up on him. But what happens if he awakened? How much chance does she have against him? She might have been able to try to get hit him or something before he got a whack in at her. But if she had missed with the first whack, that'd have been the end of it. You know, because he you would think he would have gotten the better of her. You know, if he'd managed to escape the first attack. So she was taking a risk to do this. Tremendous act of courage to do this, and yet she did it. And she was quite successful, as you see here. You know, she decided she was going to do the right thing, risk her life, to get rid of this man, and she got rid of him. And so, as it says, so he died. So it's another one of my wise women that I want to talk about is Jael. And then as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, I will show you the man whom you seek." And when he went into her tent, there lay Sisera dead with the peg in his temple. So obviously this is somewhat embarrassing for Barak, you know. No, I'm the one that got rid of him. Just little old me, just this, you know, this homemaker here, you know, housewife. I got rid of him for you. But that's what Deborah prophesied. She said that the victory would come through a woman, and that's what happened. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, in the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan. So this was the beginning of a string of victories where they finally got rid of this oppression. And then there was this beautifully inspired poem, because Deborah was a prophetess. So it says in chapter 5, "Then Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day, saying, 'When leaders lead in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Eternal.'" You know, when there are people who will step forward and lead, and others who are willing to, you know, come together for the common good, bless the Eternal. "Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes, I will sing to the Eternal, I will sing praise to the Eternal God of Israel." So you see that they're giving, of course, God the credit for the victory, though they realize that somebody had to step forward and lead, and they deserve some credit as well. Your first credit goes to God, but some credit goes to the leadership too, as we'll see if we keep reading. Well, let's go to Judges 5 and verse 12. "Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, sing a song. Arise, Barak." This would be more poetic in the Hebrew. "Arise, Barak, and lead your captives away, O son of Abinoam." So they did give credit to the leadership after giving credit to God. And now, of course, we want to give credit to Jael, who courageously risked her life and got rid of executed the Canaanite general. So let's go to verse 24. "Most blessed among women is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Blessed is she among women in tents. He asked for water, she gave milk. She brought out cream in a lordly bowl. She stretched her hand to the tent peg, her right hand to the workman's hammer." This is Hebrew poetry, parallelism. You know, repeating a concept in a different way. "She pounded Sisera. She pierced his head. She split and struck through his temple. At her feet he sank. He fell. He lay still. At her feet he sank. He fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead." And look at the end of the chapter. This is a scripture that still inspires Hebrew speakers to this day. "Thus let all your enemies," this is verse 31, "thus let all your enemies perish, O Eternal, but let those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength. Now, the Israelis have a more secular version of this verse. They sing it, "Thus let all your enemies perish, O Israel." The original statement is referring to God. "Thus let all your enemies perish, O Eternal, but that those who love him be like the sun when it comes out in full strength." So here you see wise women working. Deborah, the prophetess and administrator and judge, and then the homemaker, the housewife, with the courage to do what was necessary to deliver the country, Jael. Now there's another woman I want to talk about who very much is like Esther, plays a similar role. She has to understand how to handle a situation so that she's successful. Now see, there's two ways to handle a situation. You can be concerned with yourself, your pride, how you come out, or you can be concerned with making a success out of the situation so that everybody benefits. And she was willing to suppress her own pride, let's say, in order for a situation to come out successfully, as did Esther. And this, of course, is Abigail. So I want to talk about Abigail, and this is in chapter 25 of Judges. So we have another woman, and I want to talk about today, a wise woman doing great work, and that's Abigail. Then now Samuel, the prophet and judge, died. And he was, of course, the one who finally united the nation at the end of the Judges period. So we're a couple of centuries later now from the time of Deborah. We're in 1 Samuel 25, and we're at the time that Samuel dies. And Saul is king, and David should be taken over for Saul, but in the meantime, Saul is pursuing him. Now, David is a kind of Robin Hood figure. He's on the margin of society. He's being pursued by Saul. He's considered an outlaw. And yet, he's really a good man. He's trying to do good. So he's trying to do good while at the same time trying to stay away from the law. So as I said, he's a kind of Robin Hood figure, or very much like if you were around in the 1980s, he's like the A-Team. That's kind of modeled after David. You know, these guys that were unjustly charged with a crime, and they try to do good, but yet they have to stay ahead of the authorities. So anyway, in 1 Samuel 25, then Samuel died, and the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him and buried him at his home in Ramah. And David arose and went to the wilderness of Paran. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, which is the same area where we were dealing with before with Deborah. And the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing the sheep in Carmel. The man's name was Nabal or Naval, and there probably was another reason he got that name, but one meaning for the name is a fool. And that's, you know, what he turned out to be. As I said, there's probably not why his parents named him that. There's probably another reason why they named him that. But it does happen to mean fool. And that's what he turned out to be. A jerk, I guess, whatever you want to call. The name of the man was Nabal. And the name of his wife was Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. So she had it all. And I guess that's how this rich man got her. You know, I noticed that rich men tend to have these trophy wives, and that's what happened here. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb, so he was from a prestigious family in Judah, the family of Caleb. When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent young men, and David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel, go to Nabal, and greet him in my name. Thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity," they mention this in the translation, "Peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel." Okay, so what I didn't rob from you. In fact, I in effect protected you, because my men were there while your men were working there. "Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day." You know, it was a festive time. He was gathering in his prosperity, you know, the fruits of what he owned. "Please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David." So he was quite respectful the way he handled it. He treated the man, you know, with respect, and he had good evidence for what he had done. So when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David and waited. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse?" You know, an arrogant sort of man. "There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master." So he was in effect accusing David of being no good for running away from Saul or going against Saul. He was looking at David as a traitor. as if it were his fault. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my sharers and give it to men whom, when I do not know where they are from? So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words. Well, now David did have a problem with his temper. He was a good man but had a temper. Then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. In other words, basically the point is, I asked for it nicely. You're not going to give it to me. I'm going to take it from you. In so many words, you know. Then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. So every man girded on his sword. And David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went with David, with 200, when 200 stayed with the supplies. Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything, as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. They were a wall to us, both by night and day, all the time we were with them keeping the sheep. So as I said, they were like an informal police force, even though they themselves were on the lam. Is that the right term? They were running away. I don't know why I get this kind of reaction. Oh, I see. Yeah, that was a pun I didn't even intend to make. Well, I'm really on a roll today. Anyway, verse 17. Now therefore, know and consider what you will do. For harm is determined against our master and against all his household. For he is such a scoundrel that, you know, that no one cannot that one cannot speak to him. Okay, I see that the term was a biblical SOB, a son of Belial. You know, he's just a worthless person. You know, and they translate it here scoundrel, but literally in the margin, son of Belial. So, we can't talk to this guy. You know, so you better come up with something, because he's going to come and he's going to wipe the floor with him. And, he won't listen to reason. So you better, talk to him. Or talk to somebody, do something. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, which is more than a bushel of grain, 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. So, just as Esther, how did Esther convince Ahasuerus, Xerxes, Ahasuerus? As Dr. Hay, whenever he went over the book of Esther, he would say, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. Obviously, one reason that they went to Nabal is because they needed food. So she brought him, she was a beautiful woman, that helps, as Esther was, and she, also had all this food. So she said to her servants, go on before me, see I'm coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. So she was going to save his life in spite of himself. She had such respect for her husband, who knows how she wound up with him. As I said, it might have been a more of an arranged thing, because he was a very rich man, she was very attractive. It might have been her family might have got them married off, maybe frankly more for financial reasons. But she was loyal to her husband in any case, and she was going to protect him, even if he was too stubborn to protect himself. So it was, as she rode on the donkey, that she went under the cover of the hill, and there were David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. So you see, David was really angry, because he wasn't just asking for help. He had gone above and beyond to help this guy. In effect, he'd risked his own men's lives to protect this man. And so the man was being extremely ungrateful. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David. If I leave, frankly what he said was, if I leave one who pisses against the wall. That's what he said in George Patton kind of style. But the translators have cleaned it up. If I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. I'm not going to leave one male alive. Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground. You see how she acts? She's very, very respectful. Of course, for one thing, this man is going to be king of Israel. She understands that. And she's a female in the ancient Middle East. She understands. She's got, her pride is not what's at stake here. What's at stake is the safety of her husband and a lot of other people. That's what she's concerned about, not her own status. So she fell at his feet and said, oh, on me, my lord, on me let this iniquity be. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Please let not my lord recount this scoundrel Nabal, For as his name is, so is he. You know, Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. So, you know, it's funny how often the names in the Bible fit the character of the person. It's interesting how that works. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. You know, so if I had known something more about it, I might have tried to influence my husband. I didn't know about it. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Eternal lives and as your soul lives, since the Eternal has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal. You know, he's really not a well-liked person. He's not a popular person. Everybody's ragging on him all the time. So those people who are against you, let them be thought of in the same way. And now this present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my Lord. So I'm going to do what he didn't do. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant. It's interesting, she takes the blame. But for the Eternal he will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house. She did understand with whom she was dealing. This was David, which by the way means beloved. He was beloved of the Eternal. He was the ancestor of Jesus Christ, as we know. For the Eternal will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Eternal. You know, you're doing God's work. I know that. And evil is not found in you throughout your days. However, if you do this, you will be doing evil. This is not right. And let's keep you from this. You know, you've got a spotless record until now. Let's keep it that way. In other words, in his saner moment, he understood, no, I shouldn't have done this. I overreacted. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life. Talking about Saul, right? But the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living. This is a phrase that is now on the tombstones in the Hebrew-speaking world. This phrase, you know, may his soul or her soul be bound in the bundle of the living. This is a phrase that's put on tombstones in the Jewish community. It comes out of this scripture. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord, usually the way you see it is just the abbreviation, the first letters of the phrase, rather than the whole phrase. Just in case you're looking for it on the tombstone, you'll see the first letters of the phrase. So I'm now in 1 Samuel 25, verse 29, talking about David's life as a fugitive, which was unearned, right? He shouldn't have been a fugitive. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Eternal your God, and the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling. This was brilliant, because she reminded him of his affair with Goliath. You know, she talked about, you know, his enemies being slinged, will be what's the right word, slung out from the pocket of a sling. And so, as I said, this is very clever too, because she's reminding him of his youthful victory over Goliath. And it shall come to pass, when the Eternal has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and has appointed you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief to you. See, this would have been a stain on your record. You shouldn't do this. That this will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. You know, God says that he will avenge us, as you remember. But when the Eternal has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. So she's hoping that, you know, he will deal kindly with them when he takes the throne on her behalf, even if her husband was a ne'er-do-well, whatever the term is, no good Nick. Even though her husband blew it, you know, at least he would be good to the family because of her. Then David said to Abigail, "Blessed is the Eternal God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me." So now he understands, you know, he's cooled off, and he understands that he had overreacted. And this would have been wrong to do, obviously. What a horrible thing if he could have looked back on that record of having slaughtered all these people over this issue. You know, what a horrible thing that he almost did. And she kept him from doing it. "And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand." You know, let God deal with it. I shouldn't have to deal with it. "For indeed, as the Eternal God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried to come meet me, surely by morning light, no males would have been left to Nabal." Same phrase, I won't repeat it. Verse 35, "So David received from her hand what she had brought him, and said to her, 'Go up in peace to your house. See, I have heeded your voice and respected your person.'" So she got the job done. She was God-centered rather than self-centered, the way she behaved, and she considered other people, and she was committed to doing the right thing even if it was difficult. Obviously, she was doing a very difficult thing. How angry he was, who knows? He might have been so angry he might have harmed her, or he might have refused, you know, what she brought. Now Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. You know, I guess totally oblivious to the danger he was in. Just a very thick-headed person. Narrow-minded, whatever you want to say. And Nabal's heart was merry with him. Sometimes rich people think that they can just get away with things. Every once in a while, somebody gets caught, and you say, how did they get caught? Didn't they know they would get caught? But, you know, sometimes you just get so overconfident when you're in position of power, and you don't think you're ever going to get caught. And Nabal's heart was merry with him, for he was very drunk. Therefore, she told him nothing, little or much, until morning light. So it was in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, he was finally sober, and his wife had told him these things. Verse 37, that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. So when he heard what almost happened, it's like he had a stroke. Now, there are a lot of reasons why he might have had the stroke. You know, for one thing, he might have been angry about what she did. For another, he might have been finally terrified about what might have happened. Whatever, you know, the situation was, it affected him this way. Then it happened after 10 days that the Eternal struck Nabal and he died. So God, in effect, put him out of his misery, and he was already virtually dead. And 10 days later, he died. That was it. So when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Eternal who has pleaded the cause of my reproach." In other words, God will take care of matters in this way. You know, you don't have to do it. God will do it for you, in effect. "Blessed be the Eternal who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and has kept his servant from evil." See, I didn't do it. That would have been wrong. I stepped back and let God deal with the problem. He dealt with it. "For the Eternal has returned the wickedness of Nabal on his own head." And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. Now again, in this kind of a world, Abigail was now very vulnerable. She was a widow. And in those days, you know, women did need the protection of a male. It was that kind of a world. And one way in which that was done in those days was through polygamy. So he had multiple wives, and she became one. "When the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, 'David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife.' Then she arose, bowed her face to the earth, and said, 'Here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord.'" So she understood, you know, that she was now becoming a part of the royal family of Israel. She was becoming a part of the household of David, who had certainly a special role to play spiritually, and she was very humble and grateful about it, and she handled herself very respectfully. "So Abigail rose in haste and rode on a donkey, attended by 5 of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife." Now, if you go to 1 Chronicles, you'll find that she actually did have a child with David. In 1 Chronicles 3, "Now these are the sons of David who were born to him in Hebron, or Hebron, which was his original capital when he ruled over Judah. And by the way, by marrying Abigail, he was helping himself politically, because the Caleb family of Nabal was a prestigious family, so he was in effect marrying the former wife of a prestigious person. "Now these were the sons of David who were born to him in Hebron. The firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. The second, Daniel, by Abigail the Carmelitess." So this is a Daniel who's not that well known. It's not the prophet Daniel of later years, but this is a Daniel who was a son of David, who was the son of David and Abigail. He had also another name, which you'll find in 2 Samuel, I believe. 2 Samuel, you'll find he's called there Chileab. So he had another name, but my Daniel also has two names, Daniel Solomon. So, you know, it's not unusual to have more than one name. So you see that she even gave a child to David. She had the opportunity to bear a child to David, who was this great figure in the Bible. So again, Abigail is a model for how to handle a situation. You have to understand how to handle it, to be wise. If she had not handled the situation properly, it could have been a disaster for a lot of people. But because she did the right thing, it helped David in his career spiritually. You know, it benefited him and his relationship to God. It protected her husband, at least momentarily. It protected all of his staff. It turned out to be ultimately a blessing to her as well. You know, it was just a blessing all around. But, you know, it's because she handled it with wisdom, because she was, as I said, God-centered rather than self-centered. It's because she was concerned for others, and it's because she was willing to do the difficult thing, you know, the right thing, even though it was difficult. The right thing, even though it was difficult. Now, there's a fourth example I want to give, and that is a Gentile woman, a Lebanese woman. I want to go to Matthew 15, and here Christ goes from the land of Israel into Lebanon, what is today Lebanon, and there's a woman there living in a Canaanitish region, Phoenician region, and she perhaps was a Greek-speaking woman, and perhaps spoke to him in Greek. She could have spoken to him perhaps in Aramaic. She may have spoken to him in Greek, but it's interesting that she was a Gentile, but she recognized Christ as somebody special, as at least a man of God, you know, as the Messiah. She recognized him. Now, he went up there partly to get away from attention. He wanted some privacy, so he left his own people and went north, partly for privacy. But she knew who he was, and she went after him. Now, this woman also was doing it not for herself, but for her daughter. And this is in Matthew 15, and this was a woman of faith. She knew that this was a man of God and that this man could heal her daughter. So she was also God-centered rather than self-centered. Nor was she concerned with her own status or pride. You see how she acted here. Somebody else would have said, "How dare you speak to me like that?" Well, God can speak to you any way He wants to speak to you, you know. But she could have been offended when Jesus Christ, as a man standing there, said what He said to her. But she was not. Matthew 15. Verse 21, "Then Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, 'Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed.' But he answered her not a word." Now, so he was testing her here, testing her attitude here. "And his disciples came and urged him, saying, 'Send her away, for she cries out after us.'" So she was becoming a nuisance to them. "But he answered and said, 'I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.'" There's going to have to be a very good reason for me to deal with her, because this ministry is, in fact, a ministry to Israel, not to the Gentiles. She's going to have to give me a good reason to involve myself with her. "Then she came and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, help me.'" So evidently she really did understand who he was. She had a tremendous amount of faith and a tremendous amount of understanding. You could say that God was working with her. "But he answered and said, 'It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs.'" You don't take what the human beings eat and then give it to their pets. And this was a way of saying, you know, right now that I have my main concern, and I have my priorities. You know, I have a certain responsibility God gave me. And look at how she answers. This, you know, this could be a very humiliating remark. If you just take it on the surface and don't think it through theologically, you could take this as a personal insult. "Are you calling us Lebanese people dogs? Is that what you're saying?" You know, that's not really what he's saying, but that's how you could take it. "And she said, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table.'" You know, any of you who have pets know that. They wind up having scraps that you eat, even though probably the veterinarian tells you not to do it. You know, but you do it, you know. "Then Jesus answered and said to her, 'O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire.' And her daughter was healed from that very hour." What a woman, you know. She wasn't worried about her own situation, you know, and her own personal status. She was willing to pursue, you know, to persevere in prayer, to ask God for the help, and to in effect push him, you know, even though the answer wasn't immediate. But to get the right answer, just as Jacob wrestled with an angel at an earlier time. Now, I'd like to go to the account in Mark. Mark, as you know, was Peter's assistant, and so you'll get Peter's spin on this. I'm in Mark 7. So this is the age of the spinmeister, you know, so let's go back to ancient times here. We have four Gospels, so we have a little different thrust here in the book of Mark. Okay, so in Mark 7:24, it's basically the same account, but there's a little bit here that's different. From there he arose, this is Mark 7:24, and went to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and wanted no one to know it, but he could not be hidden. So that's why I said earlier, I think he went to this Gentile area because he figured, well, I'm not that well known up here. Yes, you are. At least this woman knows who you are. For a woman whose young daughter had an unclean spirit heard about him, and she came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth. So as I say, she very likely was what we would call a Lebanese woman, but perhaps spoke Greek. And she kept asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. But Jesus said to her, let the children be filled first. For it is not, you know, the same comment. My ministry was to Israel. You know, sorry. You know, this is the plan that's on the table, so to speak. Let the children, if you don't mind that expression again, let the children be filled first, for it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. And she answered and said to him, yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs. You know, this is similar to what we read before. Then he said to her, for this saying, go your way, the demon has gone out of your daughter. You know, it's another way of putting it, you know, that the same as before. But then it also adds in verse 30, and when she had come to her house, she found the demon gone out and her daughter lying on the bed. So she came back and her daughter obviously was sane, normal, you know, not in that state of mind she was in before. She found a sane, rational, normal daughter. And so this is the conclusion of the story. Because this was a woman, again, who was God-centered rather than self-centered, who considered others, in this case her daughter, and who was willing to do the right thing even though it was difficult. It was not easy for her to do what she did, but it was the right thing to do and she did it. I'd like to finish now by going to 2 Corinthians in the 6th chapter, 2 Corinthians 6. So here we have metaphorically watched wise women at work. We have watched wise women at work. We have seen Deborah, we have seen Jael, we have seen Abigail, and we have seen the Syrophoenician woman in the Gospels. We need to follow their example, and we need to be wise as they were. We need to be God-centered rather than self-centered. We need to be concerned for others. We need to be willing to do the right thing, even if difficult. And in 2 Corinthians 6, verse 18, Paul says to us, God's promise to us is, 2 Corinthians 6, 18, I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. This will be our destiny if we follow the example of these wise women and the works that they did. Well, I thank you for listening, those of you who did, and those of you who may hear this at another time, I thank you for taking the trouble to listen to this at another time. Enjoy the rest of this month, and the next month will be the month of the festival season. So in the meantime, all the best to you.